From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Something went terribly wrong last Saturday morning when Kansas City Chiefs linebacker Jovan Belcher shot and killed his girlfriend, Cassandra Perkins, the mother of his three-month-old daughter, then turned the gun on himself. A tragic incident of domestic violence, of guns, of rage, a man run amok. And the next day, the game went on. This hour on Point, we're going to look at this murder-suicide in the NFL and what we can learn from it about the world of pro sports and well beyond. You can join the conversation. Were you shocked or not at the news? What should we see here? What should we learn? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. It was just about a year ago, December 4th, 2011, Kansas City Chiefs playing the Chicago Bears. Chiefs went on to win 10-3. Here's Kevin Harlan and Salman Wilcots from CBS calling the play when the Chiefs' Jovan Belcher stopped Chicago Bears running back Marion Barber with a hard hit near the line of scrimmage 1 year ago.
And a two-yard loss on the play. Belcher coming through, an undrafted kid out of Maine.
Wow. Oof. He kissed Marion Barber. And it's not even Valentine's Day. Listen up.
Klutz couldn't get over there to knock him out. Yeah, that would jar your helmet free, wouldn't it? I'd unstrap your hat.
That'll unstrap your hat. That was a year ago. On Saturday morning, early Saturday morning, there were paramedics transporting a wounded Cassandra Perkins. His girlfriend, mother of his child, reported to a 911 dispatcher in this tape that the woman was gravely wounded. This is graphic.
With an early 20s female. She's been shot about three or four times. One of the chest, one of the neck, and one of the abdomen. All went through.
And then more. Jovan Belcher at a parking lot outside the Chiefs facility with a gun to his own head. Here's an officer describing that scene.
He's got black pistols to his head. I've got at least four guys standing trying to negotiate with him. Haven't made contact.
Trying to negotiate, he's got a black pistol to his head. And, of course, within minutes, Jovan Belcher also was dead. The Kansas City Star has reported in depth on this thing, talking about the Chiefs linebacker after he shot Cassandra Perkins, leaning over her in their master bedroom. His mother was in the house. I guess they got this from her. Said he was sorry, kissed her on the forehead. His mother stood in the kitchen. She rushed in. She saw that goodbye. Belcher apologized to his mom, kissed his three-year-old daughter, fled his rented home there in his Bentley and, 5 miles to the Arrowhead Stadium facility, 25 years old. And there in the parking lot, he found the Chiefs general manager, Scott Pioli, got out of his Bentley with a gun at his own head, said, "I did it, according to police. I killed her." And on it went. He thanked Pioli for everything he'd done for him. And he asked if they'd take care of his daughter. And then as they heard sirens coming and police coming, stepped behind another car. "I gotta go," the Kansas City Star reports Belcher, saying, "I can't be here." Knelt behind a vehicle, made the sign of a cross on his chest, and fired a single bullet into his own head. Looking at this, what happened here and what we can learn from it. With us right now from Washington is Kevin Blackistone, sports journalist and regular on ESPN's Around the Horn. He's also a professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Kevin Blackistone, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Buena Vista, Virginia, Sports Illustrated contributor Jeff Benedict is here. He's been reporting on violence and professional athletics for years, author of Public Heroes, Private Felons, Athletes and Crimes Against Women, and Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime. Jeff Benedict, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
There's been so much talk about this over these last few days, but given that moment of silence and the game going on over the weekend, Kevin, we thought we just didn't want to let this one go until we gave it a look and thought about what we could learn from it. What are the takeaways that you're sitting with from this terrible, tragic example of domestic violence, gun violence, a player gone so sadly wrong? What are you thinking about what we've seen here, Kevin?
Well, the first thing that struck me is the domestic violence issue. And this is one of those times when something so horrendous and troublesome strikes sports that it transcends the field and more people pay attention to it than ever before. And I was pleased to see that the Kansas City Chiefs handled the situation as they did by having everyone before the game recognize the victims in this particular case and the victims in these crimes all across the country. And hopefully the NFL going forward, as it has done with breast cancer awareness, can make this part of its platform, part of its program, to bring more awareness to this issue and hopefully some solutions to it.
Jeff Benedict, there was a moment of silence at the game that went ahead the next day there in Kansas City. There have been NFL efforts to get involved with trying to fend off domestic violence, but can you see the NFL becoming a torchbearer for awareness on this front, domestic violence, given its own history and what we see in so many professional sports?
Well, you know, that's a good question. They certainly have a bully pulpit, so to speak, because they have the eyes and ears of so many men and so many young men in this country who watch their product on TV every week. This is something that for years the NFL was in denial about, that they didn't want to address. As recently as the mid-90s, the NFL's position was, you know, we're no different than anybody else. I think that's changed a lot because the league now has efforts to, they do a lot of education in the preseason where they'll bring law enforcement experts in and others to talk to players before the season and try to educate them on this. But I think there's a limit to how much the NFL can do on this, quite frankly. I mean, they can't really control what players do in their private time when they're off the field and they're off the confines of NFL properties. And that's where these things happen. They happen in homes. They happen in hotel rooms when there aren't security guards around or coaches around to monitor these things. And a lot of these guys, they're really young. They have a lot of money. And they have a lot of free time on their hands. And these things, they happen, and they happen, frankly, a lot more than they should and a lot more than we want to acknowledge.
I mean, these NFL players are human, and this happens across a big swath of society. It's by no means limited to the realm of athletes or professional athletes, you name it. On the other hand, the idea of them becoming advocates here, I don't know. They, as they said, you know, on Sunday we play and we coach. Here was the Kansas City Chiefs coach, Romeo Crennel. This was Sunday, talking to the press after their 27-21 win against the Carolina Panthers. Crennel and Chiefs general manager Scott Pioli were the last people to see Jovan Belcher alive before he fatally shot himself on Saturday morning. Here he was on Sunday, the coach.
We are football players, football coaches, and we play and coach on Sunday. I'm choosing not to answer any questions about what I saw yesterday, and I think that you'll understand that, and hopefully you'll respect my wishes on that, because it wasn't a pretty sight.
No, it wasn't, but we play and we coach on Sunday, no matter what comes, maybe. Chiefs quarterback Brady Quinn was a little more contemplative here, maybe more thoughtful in post-game remarks, saying the tragedy might be a lesson to better connect with those around us who might be struggling. Here's the Kansas City Chiefs quarterback Brady Quinn.
You know, I know when it happened, I was sitting in my head thinking, what could I have done different? When you ask someone how they're doing, do you really mean it? When you answer someone back, how are you doing? Are you really telling them the truth? We live in a society of social networks and Twitter pages and Facebook, and that's fine and stuff, but you know, we have contact with our work associates, our family, our friends, and it seems like half the time we're more preoccupied with our phone and other things going on instead of the actual relationships we have in front of us. And hopefully people can learn from this and try to actually figure out if someone's battling something, you know, deeper on the inside than what they may be revealing on a day-to-day basis.
Chiefs quarterback Brady Quinn. Jeff Benedict, I mean, we know this is a big issue in society, domestic violence just for starters, and we're going to look more closely at that. What about this kind of violence in professional athletics in this country and in the NFL in particular, the incidence of it, Jeff?
Well, there haven't been a lot of studies on this. I did one, or was part of one, that happened in the late 90s, and we looked at every player in the NFL from the 96-97 season and found that 21% of them had been charged with a serious crime. And by serious, we meant felonies or crimes of violence. And that's 1 in 5 players. And now it's a snapshot, and you know, who's to say what the numbers would be if you did it a year later, but I think it's a pretty good reflection of the fact that the NFL has a lot of players in the league who have had run-ins with the law. That number is certainly, it stands out. 21% is a big number. And I think with the area of domestic violence or just violence against women in general, there's no data that proves that NFL players do this more than anybody else does in society. But one thing is clear. These players have opportunities that most men in America don't have with regard to their access to women. And so many times these domestic violence cases are predicated by a player being with another woman other than his wife or his girlfriend and then coming home and having a heated exchange that leads to a domestic violence incident or a call to the police. That trigger is there almost every time. I'm not saying in every case, but in most cases, that's what you find.
Very often in those cases, as in others, Jeff, charges do not end up being filed for all kinds of reasons. There are big careers on the line here.
Yeah, and in some respects, most women who are victims of domestic violence are not eager to report their case, and there are a number of reasons for that. It's embarrassing and humiliating. It's also scary to report. But for NFL wives or NFL athlete wives, it can be even worse because the attention is so much more magnified than for a typical victim.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the murder-suicide this last weekend in the NFL. Kansas City Chiefs linebacker Javon Belcher, dead. The mother of his child, Cassandra Perkins, dead. And a high-profile spotlight here on domestic violence and more. Kevin Blackistone of ESPN is with us this hour. Jeff Benedict, who contributes to the Sports Illustrated, is here. Author of Out of Bounds, Public Heroes, Pros and Cons. Here's a speech to a visibly upset football team in the locker room after the game on Sunday. The Chiefs coach, Romeo Crennel, praising his players for their effort.
Well, you did something really good today. Really good. You overcame a lot. You stuck together as a team like we talked about. Helped each other. All right. Family and friends. You relied on those people. All right. You relied on your faith to help get you through this. All right, and we got through it, all right, in a grand way because everybody made a contribution. Everybody helped, okay? And that's what a team is about. That's what a team is about. You did a very nice job with that, all right? And the win was a really good win.
A win, said the coach. The win was a good win, but you can hear the very understandable sniffling and tears in that locker room. Mark in Jacksonville, Florida is calling. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I wanted to disagree with one of your guests said that the NFL's hands are kind of tied on this. I disagree wholeheartedly, absolutely not. If the NFL from day one with these players when they signed their contract said, if you ever get involved in a domestic altercation where you're arrested or the police are involved, you're going to be suspended for... you're going to be banned from the NFL. I guarantee you these things would stop the day after tomorrow if you really, it might sound draconian, but, then again, look what happened.
Yeah, but, more than draconian. Mark, let us pick it up right there. Kevin Blackistone, what about it? Put it right in the contracts. I mean,
this
is one thing that makes the NFL different from normal life. There are contracts here.
Well, sure, but there are moral clauses in NFL contracts that speak to things like that. But what the caller is forgetting, and what a subsequent study that Jeff did and he alluded to shows, is that the rate of violence among NFL players is no greater than that in general society. So, should we have those sorts of things written into our contracts with our employers, no matter what field of work we're in? And I think most people would argue not. And those things kind of work themselves out in the court system. And if you are convicted of such a thing and put in jail, you're not going to be able to participate in your place of work anyway. So I don't think that's necessarily a solution to this, although it is a knee-jerk solution to this particular problem.
Well, Jeff, I mean, maybe, but I wonder, these are very highly paid, very high-profile people with, as you say, a lot of access. And there's a morals clause there. Why not ratchet it up in part for these players. I mean, to put a clear flashing red light, do not do this because you'll be gone.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you got to separate accusations from convictions, and you can't be kicking players out of the league because they get accused of something. They have to be convicted of it, and by the time you get to that stage, you're after the fact anyways. We're looking for ways to prevent this from happening in the first place. And so, look, I'm all for holding players accountable who break the law, and I think the NFL has been much harder on that issue than they ever have in the past, especially under this new commissioner. But if we're looking at how do we stop this from happening in the first place, you have to go back to the environment where this thing grows from. And I think it, for me, this problem starts with places like strip clubs and lots of places where some of these players tend to spend a lot of their time. And these environments are just a groundswell of problems, not just problems with violence against women, but there's all kinds of other problems. And we're familiar with these stories. They happen a lot. The problem is the NFL, it's not illegal for adult men to go to these places. You can go to bars, you can go to strip clubs, you can hang out. And I think, yes, the NFL, because of the league, has the authority to try to restrict these players as much as they can. But at the end of the day, these are men, and they have the freedom to go to these places. And I think that until that environment is curtailed, you're going to continue to see these kinds of cases be in the newspapers.
We're going to hear from Rita Smith, a top activist in domestic violence in this country, in just a minute here. But what do you say, Kevin?
I mean, I was just going to say, Tom, just one thing that I think is somewhat specious is this idea that NFL players or pro athletes have more access to women than anybody else. I mean, we just saw, you know, Dominic Strauss-Kahn enter into an out-of-court settlement for the with the maid in New York.
Okay, but he's kind of in a special category too.
Well, my point being that there are also studies that show that you know, when you control for economics, that men have the same rate of violence against intimate partners. So I don't think that players have any more access to women than anybody else, and when you control for their wages, that anybody else who earns that type of money and rolls in those sorts of circles will have the same rate of violence against women that they do.
We could argue that. I mean, they clearly have a kind of access here that comes with the money, maybe with the culture. You say others have it too. Okay, Lakota in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Lakota, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, you know, I've got a theory on this. It's called SSSS, Sudden Star Status Syndrome. And you know, these are ordinary people who get lots of money. And you know, you know, the basics in life still hold true no matter what category of job you're doing. You know, and this, and it's very true. It's not just the NFL, because you know, if you're reading a book in an airport and somebody takes a picture of you, that gets on the news the next day. So the little things you do as an NFL player, you're under the microscope. So, but they do have the same problems that all human beings have. Society is fractured. We're atrocious at relationships. And I think what they really need to do is, if they're going to help these NFL players, is to try to, you know, show them that, you know, there's a way of dealing with this stardom on the one hand and being a simple human being on the other. And they haven't, you know, there's a big dichotomy, a delicate tightrope you walk in there. You know, on the one hand, you know, you take a shower, you brush your teeth, you're a human being, and then the next minute you're out in the spotlight. And so
you're in your Bentley in this case, asleep outside a girlfriend's house in the case of Javon Belcher, hours before this shooting. I mean, Lakota, who can argue? There is a human nature at work here. Everybody needs support. Everybody needs to kind of keep a handle on here, obviously. Bob Costas looked at this Sunday night on NBC in his regular halftime segment during Sunday Night Football. talked about gun control. It was kind of almost spontaneous, maybe editorial, earned him a lot of pushback from gun rights supporters. But here's Costas. He was quoting and paraphrasing on the air halftime extensively from a piece by Fox News sports columnist Jason Whitlock.
Handguns do not enhance our safety. They exacerbate our flaws, tempt us to escalate arguments, and bait us into embracing confrontation rather than avoiding it. In the coming days, Javon Belcher's actions and their possible connection to football will be analyzed. Who knows? But here, wrote Jason Whitlock, is what I believe. If Javon Belcher didn't possess a gun, he and Cassandra Perkins would both be alive today.
Gun rights lobby came down like a ton of bricks on Bob Costas, speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC last night. He said, well, look, it's a culture that's the problem here, what he called a Wild West, Dirty Harry culture around guns. Here again, Bob Costas.
Young athletes are disproportionately armed. Tony Dungy, one of the most respected people in all the sports on our program on Sunday night, said that one year when he coached the Colts, he had 80 players before they cut the roster down, 80 players in training camp. He said, how many of you guys own a gun? And roughly 65 hands went up. Even if all those guns were obtained legally, you can't have 65 guys in their 20s and 30s, aggressive young men subject to impulses, without something bad happening.
Kevin Blackstone, what about the gun piece here? Police say they found several in Javon Belcher's home. And there's Tony Dungy, as reported by Bob Costas, saying, look at how many of these guys are around with guns. Is this just America? Ain't that America?
Well, I mean, gun violence in this country has been documented anecdotally as well as quantitatively, and we know that it's a huge issue. It's an even bigger issue in the black community. Javon Belcher was black, as was the mother of his child, for black men in particular in his age group, it's their number one killer. So it is a huge problem. The only thing I would say is that it is not. I don't think I can jump to the conclusion that had a gun not been there, that this tragic situation would have developed as it did. I mean, there are other ways, unfortunately, to kill people, and obviously in a rage, those kinds of things can happen. But certainly, it does raise the question once again. About the control of weapons in this country.
Well, I mean, it could have happened without a gun, but there's Jason
Absolutely.
Whitlock, quoted by Bob Costas, Jeff, saying, you know, he's guessing that if there hadn't been a gun, he and Cassandra Perkins would be alive today, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy thing to say, obviously. I agree with Kevin here on this, and I think it's, you know, the caller who came in just before you played those snippets from Costas used the phrase or the word ordinary to describe these players. These are not ordinary young men. I think, you know, anybody who's been around professional sports know there's nothing ordinary about being a pro athlete, because for these guys, starting at a very young age, high school or even before, they are treated differently than everybody else around them, and that different treatment escalates as they climb the ladder towards the stage of professional sports. And so the one thing I would disagree with Kevin on is, yes, these guys have is a lot of money, just like Wall Street guys and other people who get to that income level. But there's a big difference here, and that is that these players, because they're on TV all the time and they're on cereal boxes and posters that hang from kids' walls, they don't have to go pay women and people to give them what they want. The Wall Street guys pay a lot of money to get call girls. These players, they don't have to do anything. They just have to go someplace and stuff comes to them. And I
But Jeff, that's an assumption. I mean,
not an
who's
assumption,
to say
it's a fact.
But who's to say that people on guys on Wall Street with wads of money in their pockets don't go to bars down the street and have women have all sorts of women available to them as well. Who's to say that they also
don't go
to strip clubs or even own strip clubs?
Yeah, I hear you. But I don't know if trying a razor down between, you know, the lords of Wall Street and the lords of the football field is going to really take us to insight here. They're both in, high-income categories or both in different kinds of access categories play out maybe in different ways, maybe in different settings, but maybe not so different. Let me get a call here from Beth in Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
One issue that hasn't been mentioned yet is the issue of the head injuries that these players undergo and what effect that may have on their abilities with thinking clearly and all of the damage that does to them internally with their brains and all the tests that are being done on that issue.
Yeah, we've heard so much about this just recently, just this week out of Boston University. All the research that's being done on brains there and concussions that can lead to explosivity, aggression, paranoia, depression. Do we know if this was a factor with Javon, Kevin Blackstone?
We don't know that as of yet. You know, it quite possibly could be. I think the study of concussions and the effects it has on people is still a developing science. So we don't know that yet in this particular case.
I mean, no reports of concussion while he played with the Chiefs, I'm reading here, but he was listed as injured with a head injury in November of 2009. Jeff, people look at NFL activity these days and, you know, even talk about guilt watching. It's amazing to watch, but there's a lot of damage done there, and it can go to the brain and it can go to personality, behavior.
Yeah, I think probably the scariest thing facing the NFL right now in terms of its future is this whole business of concussions. There are now over 3,000 NFL players that have brought suit against the league over concussions. It's an area that's getting a lot more attention from the medical community. There are multiple hospitals in the United States right now that are studying the brains of football players. It's one of those things that I think it's lurking beneath the surface, but it's becoming more and more apparent that the violent nature of the game, no matter how well you develop a helmet or how many rules you pass about where you can hit an opposing player, this is an incredibly violent game played by super fast, very strong men. And with it, there are these ramifications. And I think as we move forward here and more comes to light about concussions, it's probably the worst aspect of the game. And the public is getting, you know, it's not at a point right now, though, Tom, where people are ready to turn off the tube. I mean, the NFL's ratings are as high as ever right now.
But maybe, Kevin, this leads the NFL to get even more involved in family and personal relations of their players if they're running these extra risks because of the battering they take.
Well, I mean, I think that's something that the NFL does slowly but surely. There are a lot of programs with a lot of teams individually and through the league and through the Players Association to help players deal with these sorts of issues. I remember when I was in Dallas and the Cowboys hired a psychologist to help out in particular a couple of players who had some issues with being bipolar and that sort of thing. And so, you know, they do that. But on the other hand, you know, these are also young men and they've been through college and they're adults and they're in society and just like all the rest of us. And sometimes they have to be, you know, accountable for themselves and people who they work with have to make them accountable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a murder-suicide in the NFL. The Kansas City Chiefs linebacker, Javon Belcher, dead. The mother of his child, Cassandra Perkins, dead. And a high-profile spotlight over the last weekend, tragically, on domestic violence. The setting was the NFL, but it is, of course, an issue in this country well, well beyond those precincts. Kevin Blackstone is with us, sports journalist, panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn, professor of journalism at the University of Maryland. Jeff Benedict is with us from Buena Vista, Virginia, contributor to Sports Illustrated and SI.com, author of a bunch of books on professional sports, athletics, and culture, as one of them says, of rape, violence, and crime there, athletes and crimes against women. Kevin, Jeff, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Rita Smith. She joins us from Denver, Colorado. She's executive director of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Rita Smith, thank you very much for being with us today. What do you see to be learned from this terrible weekend in Kansas City?
Well, thanks, Tom, for inviting me. Mm-hmm. And Kevin and Jeff, it's been a really good conversation up to this point. Your question was, are you shocked? No. Unfortunately, I'm not. This is something that happens every day in some part of the country. A woman is murdered by someone who says they love them. And I think that, you know, as your conversation has progressed, what's been really important for me to look at is, you know, this is a really widespread issue. One in four women, 25 to 30% of women in this country are victims of domestic violence. We spend over $5 billion in costs related to this in this country. 16 to 24-year-olds are most at risk. So it's an issue that is really important. I think one of the things that I would like to focus on is the fact that most men are not violent, the problem that I see in that configuration is that most men are silent about this issue. So not many people are like Jeff who are trying to point out the issue and trying to look at the culture that's creating the acceptance of this violence. And that's what I want to look at. And what I would love to do is work with the NFL to start to create good role models, to start to send out good messaging about how men treat people that they care about. I think that actually, you know, they've spent most of their resources on defending and responding and reacting to the violence. What I want to do is work with them to try to help to reduce that violence by changing the norm. And I believe they have a huge capacity to do this because they don't just influence men. I'm an NFL fan myself, and they influence women. They influence a lot of women. And so if we can start to change the messaging around what's acceptable and what's healthy and what you do and you don't do when you're angry, that we might actually be able to start to see a dramatic reduction.
You know, Rita, there's a lot of skepticism among our listeners in some respects. I mean, Katie writes to us. She says, this is not a gun control issue. This is not a steroid issue. This is a societal issue, she writes on Facebook, where men still hold the reins to do as they please, and athletes in general carry less accountability for actions in their personal life. And here another on Twitter says, you know, domestic violence is about one partner having power and control over the other. These are not violent outbursts or isolated incidents. And maybe that power ratio is even greater when, whether an athlete, athletics or not, you know, one's got the glamour and the money and the TV coverage and all the rest, Rita.
Well, I think that's true. And certainly there's a pretty high percentage of abusers within police departments as well. So, you know, or law enforcement. I think that when someone has the power and they also have the support, I can look back all the way to 1994 and when Nicole Brown Simpson was murdered. And one of the things that she had written in her journal was that no one will do anything about this because of who he is. And so I think that, you know, in 1998, I tried to have a conversation with the NFL about this, about let's look at good role modeling here. Let's look at, you have lots of good guys in your organizations. Why don't we start to hold them up as messages for the others who are new and coming in? I think that there's some power with that.
OJ in the spotlight then, Javon Belcher now, and dead. Kari's calling from Stanton, Virginia. Kari, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show.
Thanks.
The question I wanted to present was the possible link between the aggressiveness that players tend to distribute on the field and or the environment that calls for it, and maybe the disconnect in, you know, leaving it on the field and then taking it off, and, you know, where, you know, they're used to butting up head, you know, yep, butting heads and stuff like that. Maybe the disconnect and realizing that, you know, they can't, like, have their way or dealing with something aggressively as they do on the field in real life.
Yeah, it's a great question. Jeff Benedict, how about it? I mean, on the field, we heard that tape at the top of the hour. Javon Belcher could just, you know, plow his opposition down. Is it hard to turn that off when pro football players leave the field, or is that a, you know, kind of a layperson's assumption? I don't know. What do you say, Jeff?
Well, you know, the truth is obviously there are lots and lots of guys who play this game and who have no problem turning that off when they leave the field. Mm-hmm. They come home, they're great fathers, they're great husbands, and they confine that aggressiveness to inside the lines. There are some players who don't do as well doing that, but I think it's a little dangerous. To me, that's more of a crutch. in these cases, I think it's much more about guys who haven't learned how to properly treat women and who see them as sometimes as second-class citizens and treat them that way and become conditioned to view them that way because of their experience, partly that's fed through sports. And I think that that's the more overarching issue here. I'm not saying that their aggressiveness never plays a role in some of these cases. Obviously, it does in some instances. But I think it's much less important or much less of a factor than how they have been groomed to view and treat women over the years.
Kevin, what do you say? Fierce on the field and, mellow off. Is that a hard ratio?
No, it's not hard, and as Jeff said, most guys in the NFL aren't like that. They don't have that difficulty. I've covered the NFL for 20 years. I have some friends who play in the NFL now, who have played in the NFL, and all of them are great people with great families, and have never had their name show up on a police blotter. So back to Rhea's point, I mean, the fact of the matter is that most men in the NFL do not have this problem. Maybe what the NFL needs to do, and maybe what some of the rest of us need to do, is look at those who don't have the problem, who are the majority, and find out how they are able to live their lives as they do and hold those up as examples for others to follow.
Mm. Mary in Montpelier, Vermont. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. I've heard a few people, including callers, have sort of a boys will be boys mentality about this whole thing, that this just happens in society and what can we do to stop it. But I don't think I've really heard anybody say that we have a patriarchal society that is permissive to violence against women. And judicially, we don't get justice for it, and I think that's an important piece of this puzzle.
Right to the deep end of the culture there, Mary. Rita, how about it? A patriarchal society permissive of offense against women, including violence.
Well, I think there's certainly some historical foundation for that. And right now, you bring it up to the present. We have a bill called the Violence Against Women Act that was passed in 1994 that has we have statistics now that show that it is starting to make a huge difference in domestic violence. And yet, Congress is stalled on it. They cannot agree on reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. So,
what's
so
the objection?
There are some provisions that some of them have resistance to, provisions that were provided from the field saying that vulnerable populations, particularly immigrant, LGBT, tribal women, have necessary additions that need to be made to make sure that they also receive equal protections. And there's some resistance around those provisions, but they're based in actual and real need and the danger factors that are present for those populations. So, I just want... I want people to look at the fact that we have to do everything we can. Maybe it's not a gun culture issue, but what I can tell you is that statistically 68% of the domestic violence homicides in this country are gun-related. And so we need to look at how do we start to reduce the potential for those guns to be used in that way when we know and we see the signs. And there were certainly signs that this escalation was happening within this relationship. So how do we, as friends or family or law enforcement, say, this is just not a good time for you to have those guns in the house. I'll hold them for you until things start to even out for you. I think there are some actions that we can take, even if they're not legal actions, that can start to look at maybe reducing the lethal outcomes and really start to address how do we de-escalate and de-norm the use of violence because you don't like what's happened.
Well, I mean, certainly guns can take it lethal very easily. Sue in Portville, New York. Thanks for calling, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm having a real hard time listening to this show, because the lack of female input, other than your latest guest, and the complete ignorance of what's being talked about. Domestic violence is not related to being violent. It's related to control and power, and it comes from somebody who experience a lack of control and powerlessness as children. It's a learned behavior. If that's all you know when you're growing up, that's generally what you're going to do. My husband ran me over with a truck after years of violent behavior. And I was not a wealthy person at all.
Mm-hmm.
Neither was my husband. There was alcoholism on both our sides. After getting run over, they didn't arrest him for over 8 hours. He ended up getting probation. I could not get an order of protection against him because of who he was. Now, this is a man that had no fame, didn't mm-hmm. play football,
yep.
All the things that you've been talking about. A very good friend of mine who was in a very wealthy position, her husband killed her and her three children, and he didn't have a gun. He didn't need one. We're told not to tell or we'll be killed. The police department, the State Police of New York, and the emergency room staff took donations and gave it to me and told me to get the hell out of New York. Okay? This isn't about violence. It's about a learned behavior. And it's about, control, power.
Sue, we've got it. No fame, no football, no gun, and it can still happen. And I really appreciate your call. Rita Smith, it's not about all these environmental things, as Sue says, from her direct experience. It's about control and power, and if you don't address that, all the rest, you can still be left with the violence.
Well, I do think that's true. Power and control is certainly the reason why the violence is used. It's the tactic to keep control. It is definitely the most effective tool to keep control over another person. But I do think that it's important to identify that it's not always a learned behavior, it makes it more possible if you witness violence growing up in your home to repeat that pattern, but it's not a given that that's going to happen. And it's not, 100% of those kids are not going to grow up to be victims or abusers, and 100% of the abusers are not victims of previous violence in their own home. So I think that it's a learned behavior because it's a wider cultural acceptance of this violence. There's a wider cultural acceptance of particularly the more access and power a man has, the more likely it is that he will start to address, using that violence to control somebody that they want to control.
You know, Jeff Benedict, you've followed this for a long time. Rita Smith is kind of reaching out right here on the air and saying, hey, NFL, if you want to talk about this, I can be helpful. But can you really see the NFL as a locus for pushing back on the issues embedded in domestic violence in this country? I mean, after all, football itself has violence embedded in it. Is that a contradiction right there if you want to start looking at domestic violence?
No, not necessarily. And that's what I was alluding to early on in the show, is that I think the NFL has a bully pulpit. They have a captive audience. They have this whole legion of guys that, for whether it's wise or not, are looked up to by boys, men, and women who watch these games. And so they have a platform, and they have a way to reach people. And I guarantee if they took some of their most high-profile players who are living the kind of lifestyle that you want to promote, those are the guys that could have a huge impact. They could have a huge impact through television commercials, through visiting schools, through speaking in the locker room. There's a lot the NFL could do.
But aren't they selling violence themselves, every Sunday?
yeah, I mean, the game is violent. There's no question about it. The idea here is, this is a game that is embedded in our culture. Football is an American game. It's American made. It's a huge part of our culture, and it's not going anywhere, at least for a while. So I think there's a lot of good the league could do if they decided to be more proactive than reactive.
Kevin, what do you say?
I totally agree. That's why I started out talking about how the Kansas City Chiefs reacted over the weekend to this tragedy. by having a moment to remember victims of domestic violence, and hopefully to bring some more needed attention to this issue. It's much like how the students at Penn State reacted this football season by starting a campaign against child abuse. I think that's the unique role that sports can play in society. It can shine a brighter light than any other corner of society on an important issue, and hopefully bring the attention to it to get it fixed.
Rita, can you really see it? These big bone crunching guys as new spokesmen against domestic violence?
I can absolutely see it. And you know, it's like everyone has mentioned, most of these guys are really good guys. They're good family members. They're good community members. And they really can influence us in positive ways. And I really think they can have a significant impact on helping us shift this cultural norm.
Well, let's hope something like that might come out of this that would affect not only within the sports world, but well beyond. As we've heard from callers today, women in particular, this can have a very heavy toll, and does. If this story helps us get our national arms around that, maybe there's some small blessing in it. Rita Smith, Executive Director of the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, with us today from Denver. Rita, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Tom.
Kevin Blackstone, ESPN, University of Maryland. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jeff Benedict, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
In this hour tomorrow, we'll look at the best books of 2012. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.